This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Hello again, night people. How the Gemini spacecraft flies. That's our topic on Night Call tonight, and our guest is Professor Harm Buning from the Department of Aerospace Engineering, University of Michigan. And if you'd like to ask the good professor a question on how the Gemini spacecraft flies or make a comment on the latest Gemini flight, call us here at our national Night Call number. That's area code 313-846-6601. The lines are now open, and remember, you may call from anywhere in the United States collect. Please make the call station to station. The number, area code 313-846-6601. Professor Buning, are you with NASA now?
No, I'm not. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, but in the past I have been consultant to the NASA Spacecraft Center, and in that capacity I have given several courses to the astronauts.
Professor, I have a caller from Ogden, Iowa, a listener on WHO, Mr. Len Marshall. Good evening, Len. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Yes, sir.
Your comment, Len.
Yes, the professor, if he thinks it will be possible or is now possible to orbit a vehicle such as the X-15 or some variation of it.
Professor?
Well, I certainly think it would be possible. The X-15, as it is at the moment, it would have to be considerably modified before we can make a atmospheric entry with it at those speeds that it would have if it came down from orbit. X-15 is actually a space program in itself. We have been up well above the atmosphere with it, but the flight path is, so to speak, a ballistic flight path. In other words, the speed with which it comes in, although, of course, considerable, is by no means up to those speeds that a Mercury or Gemini-type vehicle would enter with. Of course, you are probably aware of the type of vehicle that recently was canceled, the dinosaur-type program, but I think that in the future, there probably will be more of this lifting-type vehicle seen around.
In other words, we'll be able to land a spacecraft? Is that what you're saying, Professor?
I think so. I think that's in the cards.
Len, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Yes, along those lines, I wonder if he has any results of tests of a glider or type vehicles that they have been testing.
Well, they have checked on this paraglider, and they have had some successful runs with that. And although I really don't know, but I believe that they are planning to, some of the later Gemini shots, perhaps to use this paraglider.
Len, thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Len Marshall, Ogden, Iowa, listener on WHO. And we now have a caller from Bismarck, North Dakota, also listening on WHO, Mr. Bruce Taylor. Hello, Bruce. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Doctor, I'd like to ask you two questions, if I may.
Yes.
The first concerns the means of communication. The communication between the ground and the satellite must be over terrific distances. And I'm wondering what frequency is used and what type of transmission.
Professor?
Yes. Problem of the distance is not one that is so very great. The vehicle flies, of course, as it flies around the Earth, it's picking up these different stations, and when it's overhead, of course, it's only 100 miles away, so the distances are not so awfully long compared to the distances that we are talking about between the stations on the ground. I'm sorry that I cannot give you the frequency that's used. The system is a VHF system, but I'm afraid that I don't have, it's not my field, and I wouldn't be able to give you any technical data on that. Sorry.
Bruce, thank you for calling Night Call. Mr. Bruce Taylor from Bismarck, North Dakota, listener on WHO. And now we go to Little Rock, Arkansas, to an Air Force base out there. Mrs. Robert L. Morris, a listener on WHO. Hello, Mrs. Morris. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, ma'am.
All right. I'd like to ask the professor, This is related to space in general. How fast do comets travel?
Oh, comets travel with speeds that are comparable to really the speeds at which the Earth travels around the sun. That type of speed, this is about maybe 100,000. So there are different comets, and their speeds vary also. But
did you say 100,000?
Feet per second.
My gosh. Well, what I wanted to ask, what I can never understand, they say that in the future that we could never pass the speed of light, which I don't believe, because if comets can go so fast, and these little fine grains of sand can retain their composition, you know, to fall in the Earth's atmosphere, why can't we go just as fast, you know?
We probably will go a lot faster than we are going now, but we are still, even those comets, you know, that's still a long ways away from the speed of light.
Uh-huh.
And also, of course, the comets that travel around the sun should a little bit different from what you would call meteorites.
That's somewhat related to, and I was wondering, interstellar travel, when they do reach that, what is the possibility of using the magnetic energy field?
Oh, yes, that will practically be the only way to go.
What?
That will practically be the only mode of propulsion that will be used for those long, long distances.
Oh, yes, and picking it up out of the space.
Well, now, what are we talking about, Professor? You've left me now.
I thought you talked about this electric propulsion.
This is electric propulsion, too, but you were talking about magnetic waves.
Yes, having the spacecraft itself utilize the energy from the magnetic field of force.
Mrs. Morse, you seem to have a great interest in this.
Oh, I've read 100 space books.
It might be, you know, psychologically, maybe you want to leave this world or something.
A very exciting field. I'm afraid I cannot give you much information on these magnetic waves. I haven't studied those too much yet.
Mrs. Morris, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Okay,
it's been a real pleasure having you with us.
Thanks.
Mrs. Robert L. Morris from Little Rock Air Force Base down in Arkansas, a listener on WHO. And back out to Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN, Mr. Bernie Mass. Hello, Bernie. Speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Okay, fine. I was curious to know if there's any sort of safety device or protection for the astronauts during liftoff. Say, for instance, if the rocket should get from 5 to 100 feet or so off the pad and something go haywire, would they be catapulted free or...
Yes, they have a little bit different system. As you know, Mercury had escape rockets, and the escape rocket took the entire spacecraft off the main rocket and delivered it along a fairly high path away from the site. The Gemini spacecraft does not use that type of escape system, but the astronauts are actually ejected like the ejection system that is used in high-speed fighters nowadays.
Bernie, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Okay, fine.
Bernie Mass from Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN. And now we have a gentleman who claims that he's in a phone booth waiting to get his turn on Night Call, and he's out in Des Moines, Iowa, listening on WHO, Mr. Gilbert Norland. Hello, Gilbert. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Well, good. It kind of irked me a little bit when I heard this man on the radio, listened to the radio.
Right.
That said that this flight was a lemon.
Mm-hmm. That was Mr. Adams from Denver, Colorado. Dave.
Yes, it was from Colorado. Well, it looks to me, and appears to me, that anyone that can take a flight and make, 160 orbits?
120.
120?
Right.
And in flight, so many miles up and so many miles around the Earth, that and come down safely, even if they didn't shave.
Yeah.
Well, what would make the difference? If I was up there, I wouldn't care if I shaved or not, if I was able to perform such a feat, you know, that would be something.
So you...
I don't know how that could be considered a lemon.
I think that Mr. Christopher Kraft, one of the Gemini flight directors, made the comment in a press conference that someone asked him this question, was it a lemon? And he said no. And the professor has also agreed that...
I think it was a marvelous spacecraft.
Well, Gilbert...
I think that Cooper and Comrade will agree with me that they probably have a great deal of love for this vehicle.
Gilbert, can I put your name in the column that says you think it was an amazing craft and a good craft and not a lemon?
You bet you can.
I want to thank you, sir, for calling Night Call, Mr. Gilbert.
One comment before you...
Why, Shirley?
I have listened to you I don't know how many times on my way home.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight I want to make this one call. And, you know, it took me almost 20 minutes to find out your telephone number.
Well, gee, I'm sorry to...
I have heard it, I don't know, hundreds of times.
Well, we'll keep shooting it out, but we do appreciate that you finally got through to us.
Well, do this for your listeners. When you... I had a pencil and paper ready.
Right.
But it was given so fast, I didn't have time to remember it all.
Okay.
And I had to wait till after the the station identification...
Right.
...was over to finish it up.
Well, we'll try and give that number a little bit slower for you. Thank you for your suggestion, Gilbert.
All right.
Good night. Mr. Gilbert Norlin from Des Moines, Iowa, a listener on WHO, a gentleman who waited at a phone booth to get his call through the Night Call. The lines are now open, and that number that Gilbert was concerned about is area code 313-846-6601. And we have 2 minutes left in this section of the program, and I think we'll have time for a caller, Mr. Robert Moore from Burley, Idaho, a listener on WHO. Hello, Robert. Speak right up.
I'd like to ask a question to the doctor.
Yes, sir.
On the Gemini 5 spacecraft, if electrical failures or damage to the spaceship controlled, could the spaceship be landed or maneuvered while in orbit by
the astronauts, huh? That's an interesting question.
That's a very good question, and I think that if we say that indeed there are no controls whatsoever, that probably would be a pretty grim situation. But we have built in the spacecraft, there is a considerable amount of redundancy. In other words, one system can completely go out, and there will be another system that is completely independent, you see, of the first system. And actually, with the package that still is attached to the back, there are actually more of them than two systems, so that the chance that there actually would be no control whatsoever on the attitude to begin with, that chance is phenomenally small.
And there's no way the spaceship could be guided after damage or anything.
Well, a lot of damage can happen to some of the systems, but what we need in order to land the spacecraft is that we do need to have a proper attitude when the retro rockets fire. And if we can't get that attitude, why then that's a grim situation.
I see.
That's the critical point then when they come into the atmosphere.
As soon as the aerodynamic forces begin to take over, then the thing is stable aerodynamically. But before that, we have to get in the right attitude.
Robert, thank you for calling Night Call. Mr. Robert Moore from Burley, Idaho, listener on WHO. Our guest tonight, Professor Harm Buning. Our topic, How the Gemini Spacecraft Flies. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call. This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
And welcome back to Night Call, Night People. Our guest tonight, Professor Harm Buning from the Department of Aerospace Engineering, the University of Michigan. And this is a gentleman who has been an advisor to our astronauts. And if you'd like to call us here at Night Call, the number to call is area code 313-846-6601. Now dial us direct. If you wish, you may make the call collect. You may call us from anywhere in the United States. Please make the call station to station. The number again is area code 313-846-6601, and our lines are now open. And I would like to invite you, the Night Call people, to drop us a note. Drop it to Night Call to the station that you're listening to, and let us know what topics you'd like to talk about or hear about on Night Call, and any comments that you have on the program or any of our guests. We appreciate hearing from you. That's just Night Call in care of the station that you're listening to. Professor Buning, I have a caller now from Duncan, Oklahoma, a listener on WHO, Mr. Roy Reese. Roy, speak right up your comments, sir.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Professor, I was wondering if the capsule, the spacecraft, rather, was 180 degrees from the correct position when the retro rockets would fire, would that would keep them from breaking down to come back in orbit, would it not? And also, is there any possibility of that ever happening?
Well, you're quite right. If the spacecraft were 180 degrees from the position that it normally is, when the retros fire, the retros would just do the opposite thing of what we want. It would loft the spacecraft farther away from the Earth instead of letting it come in closer in. The chance for it happening is not existing, really, because I would presume that... again, if we had a complete loss of all control of the attitude of the spacecraft, I would presume that under those circumstances, we wouldn't fire the retros.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, what we probably do is maybe, if you don't dwell on that point, if there were no control, we would perhaps, if it tumbles, you see, we'd wait till it goes to the right position and then just hit it very fast.
Roy, I hope the professor has answered your question.
Sure has, sir, and I surely do thank you.
Thank you, Roy Reese from Duncan, Oklahoma, listener on WHO. And now we have a lady, Lorraine Deal from Eldora, Iowa, a listener on WHO. Hello, Lorraine. Speak right up, ma'am. You're on Night Call.
Thank you. I've been very much interested in all of the astronauts' flights, and I think it's a wonderful scientific achievement. And I think we owe a great deal to our astronauts and to all those who have worked with them in the program. But there is one thing that I'm very much concerned about.
Yes, ma'am.
And that is in having only three men who go to the moon. They say two of the men will get out of the capsule and explore the moon. And that will leave only one man in the capsule to do all of the work. And with some of the systems perhaps causing trouble, or maybe you couldn't read a computer correctly, I think two men using both of their heads and all of their physical ability, probably, in the capsule will be absolutely necessary. And I don't think they should send the men to the moon unless they can have at least four and possibly five, maybe a physician along with them, in the capsule. They should wait until they can have a big enough capsule and be sure of it, because it might just be too much for that one man.
Professor, what do you think about that?
Well, I thought, I would think, of course, truly the more the merrier, you see, but the way this entire operation is planned, it is a relatively safe operation from that point of view that you mentioned. The command module, which stays in orbit around the moon, all fella will be busy, but I don't think that there is a real overload for him. And the people who designed this entire mission have made sure that one man can handle the problem up there while he waits for his two buddies to go to the moon's surface and come back up again.
But even so, a very healthy person can become suddenly ill, and he might get a headache or something.
Well, this is...
I hope they have aspirins on the spacecraft.
This is, of course, a problem with all this type of flying. It's a problem with Mercury also. I should say that I'm pretty certain that even if the command module that stays in orbit around the moon, if that were completely passive, that is to say that the man inside didn't do anything at all, that even so, the lunar excursion module could actually come up and mate with it without... any active support, although I'm sure it would help a lot.
Lorraine, thank you for your comments.
Thank you very much.
A lady from Eldora, Iowa, who's concerned about the welfare of our astronauts and suggests that we maybe send 4 or 5 to the moon. Let's go now to Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a listener on WBAL, Mr. Peter Bryan. Hello, Peter. Speak right up. You're on night call.
I have 2 questions for you.
Yes, sir.
1, what happens if they have to come down on land?
Okay, Professor, what happens?
At the moment, we are not with the spacecraft such as GT-5 and GT-4. It's not really planned that they would land on land. And we feel that it's felt that there's enough ocean that they fly over that we can plan on landing on the ocean.
If the craft did come down on land, it would be fatal, would it?
I really am not quite sure of that. It'd be quite a jolt, I'm sure.
The other question, Peter?
This one is directed to you. First of all, I listen to this program when I get out of work. I'm just getting home from work now. It's 3 o'clock up here.
Right, it's only 2 here, coming up to.
You asked just a couple minutes ago when I was coming home on suggestions as to future programs.
Right.
Are you planning on anything on physical fitness nationwide?
I believe we are, and we have had a show on, generally on that topic about athletics and the benefits for a boy. But we will be doing something along that line, I'm sure. And I'll pass the word on to our producer, Stan Nock, down in Washington, and I'm sure he'll line up some people for us.
Well,
Peter?
I've only been listening to it for just about 3 weeks, and I enjoy it very much.
Well, you're very kind, and thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you.
Mr. Peter Bryan from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a listener on WBAL. And now let's go to Fort Cobb, Oklahoma, a listener on WHO, Mr. Don Jones. Hello, Don. Speak right up. You're on night call.
My question concerns re-entry.
Yes, sir.
When they're ready for re-entry and fire their retro rockets, does this slow the vehicle down to where gravity will pull it earthward, or does it change the course of the vehicle and shoot it earthward?
No, your first statement is the correct one, sir. It actually slows down the vehicle is oriented so that the thrust is backward along the trajectory and slightly downward. So actually, it does really 2 things. It gives an incremental velocity to the vehicle, which is a little bit off the flight path. So it does 2 things. It slows it down. That is the most important fact. And it also changes the angle of the path just a little bit.
Did the astronauts come in upside down this time when they entered the key?
Once they get into the atmosphere, they are upside down. That is to say, their heads are pointing towards the Earth.
Is there a reason for that?
The reason for it is that the vehicle is designed so that the lift force, the force is a little bit different vehicle from the Mercury. You see, this vehicle flies at a slight angle. It's a body of revolution, but the center line of the vehicle is about 16 degrees off the direction in which it's flying. So it's developing a lift, and this lift is directed towards the pilot's feet, so to speak, or towards his feet.
Don, I hope we've answered your questions.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for calling Night Call. Mr. Don Jones from Fort Cobb, Oklahoma, a listener on WHO. And let's go now to Battle Creek, Michigan, a listener on WHO, Mr. Tom McCullough. Hello, Tom. Speak right up. You're on night call, sir.
Thank you, and I'd like to address my question to Professor Beauty. We were told that in the last few days of the GT-5 mission, the astronauts were encouraged to conserve power and allow the ship to tumble because too much water was accumulating from the operation of the fuel cell. Now, was this because of insufficient consumption of water or inadequate water storage capacity or merely an error in design assumption, and what would the remedy be?
Well, I'm afraid that I cannot answer that in detail. I really don't know more about the problem, actually, than one can read in the paper. I believe that there was more water than probably one expected, and that it's collected in a sort of a bladder-type container, and what they were worried about is that this water finally would back into the tank, and I'm sure that this is something that's going to be remedied on the following flight.
Well, was there no way to dump this water over the side, as it were?
Well, apparently that was not in the plans. I don't frankly know quite why or why not, but
Apparently, that was not the way it was intended to be done.
But Tom?
I cannot think of a reason, by the way.
We're just about up time-wise, so I want to thank you for calling Night Call, Mr. Tom McCullough from Battle Creek, Michigan, a listener on WHO. And, Professor, in 30 seconds, let me ask you, do you think, man, that we're going to beat the Russians to the moon?
I think so.
Our guest tonight, Professor Harm Buning. Our topic, how the Gemini spacecraft flies. Professor Buning is with the Department of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Michigan. Again, I'd like to invite you Night Call people to drop us a line here at Night Call to the station and that you're listening to, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear in the future or topics that you'd like to comment about. That's Night Call in care of the station that you're listening to. Tomorrow night on Night Call, our guest is Dr. Aloysius S. Church, our topic, Who is an Alcoholic? Professor Buning, I want to thank you for being our guest on Night Call. Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station as a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.